regard to the Measure 37 claims process, so we'll ask David Hardwick, Lane Cheddarly, and Keith Cutler all to come forward and share the dais together to give this committee an update on the claims process and what's happening. Lane, since you're the most familiar face that we have before this committee, I'll ask you to start off, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have with me as well Ron Eber, for the record, Lane Cheddarly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Good to see you all again. I have with me today Ron Eber from the department. Ron is our farm and forest specialist, but in this day and age has also assumed a leadership role in the handling of Measure 37 claims within the agency, and has worked with us and with the Department of Administrative Services in helping to craft the state claims process. So I thought I would invite Ron in case any questions would come up about issues relating to the claims in the department that he might be able to answer. I think what I may do, Mr. Chair, is defer to David Hartwig. David is from the Department of Administrative Services with Keith Cutler, their legal counsel, and as you know, the state has adopted a process whereby the Department of Administrative Services has been designated to receive all claims that have come into the state under Ballot Measure 37. The thinking behind that was that since Ballot Measure 37 extends by its definitions to more than just those rules and regulations and statutes that would fall under the Department of Land Conservation and Development, we needed some place that was suitable to be a central receiving point for all of the potentially affected agencies, and DAS serves that function on many other levels, and so was designated as the central receiving agency to receive all claims. They act as an initial level of review and then refer the claims out to the regulating entities that have the jurisdictional authority over the claims, where the claims get substantively reviewed. I think David will probably have more information about that. And so, with the chair's permission, I'll ask Mr. Hartwig to kind of talk generally about the state claims process, and then I can bring it back to DLCD or answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board, committee. My name is David Hartwig. I'm administrator of the State Services Division and the Department of Administrative Services. That division is a consolidation of risk management, state procurement office, fleet administration, and surplus property. Thought I would give you a pretty high level of the steps that we followed in developing the claims process for Measure 37. How we started that was back in 2000 when Measure 7 passed. DAS was identified as the lead agency for that initiative. DAS put together a project team to develop an implementation plan for Measure 7. We did that because DAS has experience in managing state claims made against the state, has the ability to enact statewide administrative rules, also would make payments on behalf of the state if that were to occur, and also is the state agency designated for all claims to be filed that are made against the state. The initial Measure 7 group put together several draft documents. They include administrative rules for handling claims, position descriptions for positions that might be hired to implement the plan, policies and procedures, and a process description and a flow chart. It was determined that if Measure 7 were enacted, DAS would utilize this plan, the Measure 7 plan, as the foundation for developing temporary administrative rules. The rules would provide for filing and reviewing of Measure 37 claims, establishing claims coordination, maintaining a claims registry, partnering with regulating agencies regarding the determination of adequacy of the claims information that was provided on the claim forms, notification of adjacent property owners, and obtaining property appraisals if they were needed. To do this, we established a rules working group. It was comprised of members from the original Measure 7 group, as well as others, representatives from Department of Justice, DLCD, Parks, Forestry, Agriculture, and Department of Transportation participated. Staff from Legislative Finance Office attended many of the meetings. And the group met with the administrator of the Appraiser Licensing Board and the president of the statewide appraisers organization to get their input. The first meeting of this group occurred in October on the 27th, and the group affirmed that they would use the material developed for Measure 7 as a starting point. And the main thing, the first thing that the group wanted to do was to develop the temporary administrative rules. Everything would fall else would fall out of that. Our claims process, our claims form, and how we would define our relationship with the regulating agencies, all would come out of the development of those temporary rules. The rules would give definition to terms and describe the claim process. The goal was to have a process that was logical and a reasonable requirement for information needed to make a thorough analysis and decision on claims that were submitted. We wanted to use terms and informational processes that were common to recognize proceedings regarding property and land use issues. The group met frequently from the end of October through the end of November. On November 30th, our temporary administrative rules were filed with the Secretary of State and became effective. During the time that the rules group was meeting, we also had an internal state services division team meet, and it included DOJ as well. And we began to meet, participating in and monitoring the work of the rules group. And it was important because we needed to develop a claim form and a process, and we wanted to mirror the work developed by the rules group so that consistency was obtained in how we requested information on claims and how we responded to information submitted from claimants. Other activities that the division group worked on included drafting letters to communicate the status of claims to claimants, providing notification to neighbors, and documenting the transmittal of claims to the appropriate regulating agency. Other work that needed to be done based upon the rules, aside from developing a claim form, was to develop data fields for entry into a claims management system. And this claim management system data would also be used to create and initiate a state registry of claims filed. We completed this work, and on December 1st, posted on our website the temporary administrative rules as well as the claim form. On December 2nd, we began receiving claims, notices of claims, and questions about how to file a claim. To date, there's been 127 claims filed with the state. We've been able to process 84 of them that have been forwarded to DLCB. We have one claim that will be going to the Marine Board and one claim that will go to Forestry, and that leaves 41 claims pending action, pending completion of their review. To date, we have not sent notification to any adjacent property owners, and we have not initiated any appraisals regarding questions over compensation requested in the claims. We work closely with DLCD in reviewing the claims and our process. We have initiated a revision of the temporary administrative rules. Doing this, we want to ease the claim filing process and enhance our ability to more promptly review claims when they're submitted. We'll continue to review our process and partner with DLCB. We do have a time frame in which permanent rules need to begin to be developed. That process will need to start by April 6th and be completed by May 27th. There's some handout material I provided for you. You have the current temporary administrative rules. You have the draft of the revised temporary administrative rules and also a copy of the claim form that we're currently using. The two sections that are most connected to the claim form of the rules would be Section 30 and Section 40 in regards to information that we're requesting be filed with the claims. The biggest distinction between the current rule and the revised rule that's submitted is in changing terminology in regards to what is to be submitted for a claim. We're transitioning from requiring information to suggesting what should be submitted for evaluation and proper determination of a claim. I guess with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Harwood. Committee, questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may, just to follow up on what David said, I think at our level, the effort has been to create a claims process that is accessible and that does not serve as a barrier or impediment to the filing and processing of claims. When we drafted the first set of rules that you have there, that of course was done somewhat in a vacuum since we didn't have any claims. We used the first round of claims to really test against the rule and the claim form, and I think we found that inadvertently there were areas that really were posing harder problems for claimants than we had anticipated, and so that's why you see this set of draft rules using that experience of the first set of claims that have come in to actually design a process that is more accommodating even than the process that we began to allow for the processing of these claims. We do not want the battleground to become denial of claims because we didn't get a dot, an I dotted or a T crossed. That doesn't serve anybody's purpose. We want to look at the claims to the extent that we can get them to the regulating entities and have them evaluated on their merits. That, we believe, is in the best interest of the state. That's most efficient for our purposes, and it also serves the interest of the claimants. So that is the direction that we've been going to try to facilitate the filing of claims, to get them to the regulating entities where the expertise resides, and to the extent that we need more information when we get a claim at DLCD, we'll pick up the phone or send a letter and ask somebody for information to try to get the information that we need to fully evaluate a claim. So we're doing the very best we can to make this process work with the claimants that are coming to us.
Lane, if a claimant's application comes from DAS to your department, are you then requesting an appraisal?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have not. I guess Ron is most familiar with the individual claims. We have not at this point requested an appraisal. As you know, the state does not require an appraisal as an element of the filing. We have it in the rule that we can conduct an appraisal if we feel it necessary. But Ron, if you want to address that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber with the department. I'm told that some of the claims have been submitted with appraisals. The ones I have seen have not, and there's a wide range of information that's submitted to document that there's been a reduction in fair market value. How exactly we will analyze that and determine that there's adequate evidence to demonstrate that there is some reduction in value, we don't know. We're still trying to figure out what reduction in fair market value actually means as defined by the Act, and you know how we will determine that. You know, when you look at the claims, at least, you know, just straight up, a lot of them are pretty obvious. Yes, there's a reduction in value. If you divide the property into 10 5-acre lots, it's with houses, it's going to be worth more than it is with one house or no division. In some cases, having to determine an exact reduction value isn't really relevant because we all know there isn't any money. So once you can at least determine that there has been some reduction in value beyond what anybody is willing to pay, then we really move to the waiver.
So it's kind of automatic that it, the determination of an actual loss really isn't necessary. I mean, as long as there is proven to be a loss. Am I hearing you right there?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah. I think before you can get to the question of a waiver, you have to determine that there's been a reduction in value as a result of, you can't do, the way I describe it, you can't do something today that you could do at the time you acquired the property, and that results in a reduction in fair market value. And when you can answer that question, yes, then you move over to, since we can't pay, what are we going to either remove, not apply, or modify in terms of the offending regulation?
Okay.
Sure.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, sir. Can we follow up on that a little bit? That sense of an evaluation intrigues me. We had a list from Deschutes County the other day, and that list had on a request for, I think it was 14 subdivisions, with several hundred lots being created in the 14 subdivisions. I wonder whether that value is calculated on the basis of, let's say, I have one subdivision, I'm the only one, and there's a market here, and now I can create 20 houses, and those 20 houses or those 20 lots will have a value. That's one kind of assessment. But if we create 500 lots, you might not be able to sell any of those 20 lots. They may have no value at all. I wonder if that assessment model includes looking at the change in the market for all the requests that we're getting, or only relates independently to one as if it were the only one that were happening.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, we've struggled with that same question, and when we met with the chair of the appraisers board, he raised the same conundrum. You know, we had a defined land market out there, and the appraisers could make evaluations. Now we sort of have this great unknown. We don't know what the market is, and how we factor that into evaluation is something we're aware of, but we haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, I think that is at the front end of these claims, and you're addressing the question of market saturation, basically, when you get to a point that you've got so many lots on the market, when is one more lot worth anything? I think trying to apply what I think you heard on Monday is a rule of common sense to this. We're not there yet in terms of this market saturation. When will we get there? I don't know, but I think at this point in the world, that's not an issue that we're particularly concerned about.
Yeah, let me follow up, sir. Let me follow up. Looking at that Deschutes County lot, for example, there were some of them that had dozens or maybe 100 lots created, and some were creating 8 lots on 110 acre. Piece, and it's conceivable that it would be less valuable, given their home market, with divided up into 8, than it might be as a 10-acre piece under those kind of circumstances. I mean, it just seems that's a very important issue if we're talking about, it could lose value by being subdivided rather than increase value by being subdivided.
I guess I would just, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, just say in general, we're just, now that we have the actual claims in front of us, we're able to move from this very general, what does Measure 37 mean, to having to look at a specific fact pattern and situation and apply the terms of the Act into actually drafting a report. Because I can look at a claim and go, yeah, this probably will make it, or this one might have some problems, or we're going to have to work on it. But when you actually try and put pen to paper, although we really don't do that anymore. Fingers to the keyboard. I can say that I've been with the department for 29 years, and I've examined every manner of land use decision and written every manner of report, and I'm finding these probably the toughest thing I've ever had to do. You know, even just determining who the owner of the property is, given some of the shifts in ownership within families and in and out of trusts and whatnot is vexing. It's very difficult, and it's going to be a challenge. We're determined to get all the reports done. We've gotten 64 to date, and based on what the numbers from David, it looks like there's another 60 coming our way. It's going to be a challenge to get all the work done, but we're determined to do it and beat the 180-day deadline. But it's going to be real tough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dunlap.
Thank you. Mr. Shanley, Mr. Eber, I don't know which of you can answer this, but I heard Mr. Eber say that it's pretty clear we don't have any money to compensate. Who made that decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I did in part, and so did you in the last session, just in terms of the budget that's been allocated. We don't have any money in the DLCD budget to begin to pay compensation claims. We don't have any other resources that we can draw on to pay compensation claims based on the statutes or administrative rules that we administer. So I don't think it's telling tales out of school to say that we've just not identified any funds, and certainly none have been directly appropriated to the department to pay compensation claims.
Quick follow-up. Didn't I hear the governor say that that was his preference? So has there been an evolution since then?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I think that was looking really more in forward terms. So certainly when the measure passed, we were in the middle of a biennial budget that was already adopted, and it's going to be up to the legislature working with the governor's office and all the agencies to determine what the budget priorities are going to be going into this next biennium. I know there's been a shift, but I think everyone recognizes the competition for the resources.
Thanks.
Wayne, have you, in your initial processing of claims, the type of claims, have you seen a trend one way or the other? The committee was somewhat shocked. Here we go through Washington County and there's 60 claims and only two are for subdivisions. We go to Deschutes County and 13 out of 16 are for subdivisions. Is that the kind of trend we're going to see, that it's going to vary that much from district to district or county to county?
Mr. Chair, I'll ask Ron to answer that. We were just this morning starting to put together our first break on the itemization of claims and types of claims. We may have some information here to be able to give you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber again. In looking at a quick printout, we haven't done a specific analysis. I would say most of the claims involve some form of land division and additional houses, and that can range from 2 to 3 or 4 up to 300. I'm aware of one out of Fayette County. And so we haven't done any detailed analysis yet, but I think there are a few where it's one house on one lot, but most seem to want some land division to create multiple lots with houses. I would say we have worked out an arrangement with the Department of Agriculture where we will hopefully in short order we can take, as we log in the claims and put the location coordinates in here, we will have a way to get those mapped out in a GIS map so we can begin to see where these claims are actually being filed. You know, are they aggregated in one place? Are they spread out? And we'll have some more information, but that's going to take several more weeks, I think.
Do you have a date by which you might have a preliminary printout or idea as far as the type of claim? And is the state claim going to differ or vary from what the counties are seeing?
Mr. Chair, I don't know how long it will take us to tabulate this. I think there's a sense that there are a number of claims filed at the local level that haven't been filed at the state level that probably should be, and vice versa. And there are some, obviously, where they've been dual filed, but I don't think anyone as yet has done a comprehensive look at that.
Would a week be a reasonable amount of time? to get back to this committee with some kind of a trend?
Somebody on it to start tapping.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm sure we could have something just in even in rough terms.
That's all I ask.
We have here within, I would say, by next week.
Thank you.
To give you what we've got in terms of claims and the local jurisdiction, the current zoning, the amount of acres, the declared use. We can get you that information off of our records.
I would note not all claims specify, you know, specifically what they're asking for. You know,
how do you make a claim without asking for?
Well, they ask for an amount, a reduction in fair market value, and sometimes it's they want a waiver to be able to do what they could do at the time they acquired the property, and that's not always clear. You know, some people are real clear. They want three lots and three houses. Others are more general. And
well, people are asking just to get their old designation back with no plan to do anything with that designation.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It's not clear.
No, Mr. Chair, with no plan, at least not a declared plan. Mm-hmm. They may have their own plan, but they're not saying what that plan is on their claims.
Probably more time than not, they specify something, because a lot of the claims say, we really don't want any money. We want to be able to do X. Mm-hmm. And, of course, before we can get to that point, we have to determine that there is a reduction in fair market value.
So it's not unreasonable for us to ask you, say, to come back a week from today and give us some kind of preliminary idea of the trends, statewide only on the claims.
Mr. Chair, it's unreasonable to ask Mr. Lieber because he'll be on vacation next Wednesday. But just tell him
he can't go, Wayne. I mean, that's all there is to
it. I can be here. We'll get somebody here with you. We can get that information for you.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. Any further questions? Thank you, and we'll move on to Mr. Cutler, Department of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I did not come here with any prepared remarks. I came here available to answer any questions that you might have for me.
Any questions from the committee? Well, I'll start off. Based on the preliminary information that we've had in this committee so far, Department of Justice is the bottleneck in Measure 37 at this point, in that there has been no legal determinations given to LCDC in helping them process claims or in helping our counties process claims. It's been apparent, and I don't mean to speak for this entire committee, I'm speaking for myself only here, that it's been apparent to me that the counties and the testimony we've had are all over the place as far as their application forms and how they're doing their own interpretations. It would seem to me that you as the Department of Justice of this state have a serious obligation as soon as possible to give our counties and to give our agencies legal determinations. Even if they're wrong, we'll let the courts decide it, but this state needs something now.
Mr. Chair, the Attorney General, of course, does advise the state agencies, the governor, whoever asks him for legal advice. But the Department of Justice does not represent the counties. Counties have their own legal counsel. So we can't offer them any advice, and nor have they asked us for advice as far as I know.
Well, wait a minute. DLCD is telling the counties that the claimants need to file both a dual state and county claim in order to kind of cover themselves. Isn't that giving the counties some legal advice?
Mr. Chair, if DLCD is doing that, I think it's prudent. I think it's probably something that the claimants should do for themselves. But I don't think DLCD gives legal advice, and I don't believe that is legal advice to the counties or the claimants. I mean, it's a good idea, but that's not what I call it within the realm of legal advice. Legal advice, as I understand it, is when a lawyer is asked by a client to answer a question. We have been asked some questions by the state, from the governor's office, from DLCD, et cetera. We're working with them on developing answers to those questions. We're going as fast as we can, and we're developing those answers. But it's up to our clients to tell us when and how we deliver those answers.
And would you identify your clients?
the state, DLCD, any other agency that's asked questions, the governor's office, we're working with primarily, and I have to temper these comments with, I'm the person who's responsible more for procedure than substance. That's why I'm here with Mr. Hartwig. But on the substantive side, I believe we're working with the governor's office, with DLCD, perhaps with forestry, and maybe a couple of other agencies.
How many requests, or have you received any requests for a legal definition of Measure 37? How many requests have you had from state agencies in that regard?
Mr. Chairman, we have, you know, generally speaking, a lot of questions on the table that we're trying to address. We're trying to address the big questions first, what are meanings of particular sections of the measure, and we're trying to get that advice done in a form that the governor's office and other clients have asked for it.
Do you have any idea when you're going to, how many responses have you issued to this point?
I don't know the answer to that.
Anyone else? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, to follow up on this point, I think what we need, and I think we're looking for direction from the agency or from the Attorney General's office, is a set of standards that would apply statewide to the processing and implementation of Measure 7, and below that line, what would be still a matter of local control. And that's a very fine line. Are you capable of organizing those issues for us so we get some idea at the state level what the state agencies would like to see as statewide standardized practices and what could be left to local control? Can you organize issues that way without coming to legal advice, without drafting legislation? Could you make that draw for us? Just what would be best in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I believe we can do whatever task we're asked to do along those lines, up to the point that everybody needs to understand that whatever we issue at the Department of Justice is binding and applies as to the state agencies that we advise, but it doesn't have any bearing on what counties do other than if they choose to be bound by it.
To follow up on that, I don't think that answered my question. I'm really looking for advice. We're not asking for advice. We're asking some policy decisions to what issues you think should be best left for statewide standards and what issues should be left to local control. It's not advice. It's just asking to help us draw that line. It seems to me the state has an interest in that. Otherwise, we could do it for you. You might come in and say, well, gee, that's a statewide function. We don't want that to go to local control. And we're going to be battling this thing out issue by issue by issue by issue over the next several months, or we can organize this and try to see how a plenary line can be drawn between state authority and local authority.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, in terms of developing policy, unless it's legal policy we're talking about, I don't believe that's the role of the Department of Justice. And we can, as I say, answer questions. If you have questions as to, as a matter of law, what does the measure say might be a statewide standard or what might not be, that's something we can answer. As to a policy question as to what should be done according to statewide policy and what should be done according to local policy, that seems to me to be the function of policymakers like the governor, Mr. Shetterly perhaps, and state agencies. I don't understand that to be the function of the Department of Justice.
Okay, thank you.
It's nice to have an attorney on the committee, by the way. I'm trying to understand because last week Mr. Shetterly indicated that there was hesitation on the part of DLCD to make some decisions without having a legal decision from the Department of Justice. Now, you're saying we didn't do that. At least that's what I'm hearing you say, I think.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is we do provide legal advice. We provide legal advice based on the questions that are asked of us. We are engaged in that process now with respect to Measure 37. What particular question Mr. Shetterly was talking about last week, I don't know, because I wasn't here. but he's in close contact with my colleagues in the department, and I'm sure they're discussing legal issues on a regular basis.
And who in your department work? Elaine, maybe this is a better question for you. Who do you work with that department?
Mr. Chair, that was Richard Whitman, who was with us last week. Okay. He's our contact attorney on the Measure 37 issues. If I may weigh in, just in terms of perhaps in addressing someone, Representative Ackerman's question, you don't see an opinion, there's a written opinion from the Department of Justice, but in the rules, for instance, there is legal advice subsumed in all of those rules in terms of both what's there and what's not there. For instance, there's no filing fee, there's no requirement on the state's part that an appraisal be filed. Those are all decisions reflected in the rule that derive from legal advice given by the department. And so to some extent, even though there is no written legal opinion to guide, the product of the claims process, for instance, is very much based on legal advice from the department. What we are waiting for, what we are dealing with in the next phase, having gotten through that claims process and setting up the elements of that process, now we are working with the Department of Justice, and they are answering, or will be soon answering, some of those more substantive questions that we need to know as we deal with the claims now as they're coming through. So it's been somewhat of a continuum here, beginning with the advice we needed first to create a claims process just to get these things in. And now that the claims are coming in, the questions that relate to the claims and the interpretation of the substantive elements of the measure.
Has waiting for those decisions from the Department of Justice slowed your process down at all?
Mr. Chair, I would say it's not slowed us down, recognizing that we have the 180 days. I mean, we're confident that we'll have all the answers we need by the time we need to be making the final cuts on these decisions. Mr. Whitman and the other attorneys at the Department of Justice that we work with are fully aware of that deadline. So I don't know that we wouldn't be popping out claims today probably anyway. I think what you heard on Monday, and even what you heard from us last week, was concern about some of the larger issues in terms of state and local relationships, authority or responsibility to waive. I think we're going to get some guidance on those questions very soon.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Wilmick, I apologize.
Thank you. What's on the mind of some of us on the committee is there are a ton of ambiguities in this law. And we've heard over and over that there are a bunch of ambiguities. And there are a variety of ways to deal with those ambiguities, including waiting 10 years and seeing what the courts say about them, or trying to fix some of them with some specific language. I guess what some of us are wondering is whether we're going to get some guidance on the interpretation of those ambiguities, at least as expressed in an attorney general's opinion on them. Understanding the full limit of that doesn't have the effect of law, but we were sort of hoping. I mean, we raised a question earlier on whether you could file a waiver without there being a specific loss. I'm not sure that's clearly in the law, although it may be. I get confused every time I read it. But there are lots of other ones, like the question of does a waiver go with the land? And I would hope that there will be some attorney general's opinion to at least give us one citing on this soon.
Mr. Chair, I'm confident we'll see it soon.
Because if you don't, then we have to.
Well, we may have to anyway, but at least we want to do it in that.
Yeah.
At least we want to see that in right.
Yeah.
They're certainly aware of our situation and need for guidance on that, so I don't think there's any lack of attention on their part. I think that certainly it's a high volume of questions, and I shouldn't be one jumping in to answer for the Department of Justice, except that I do appreciate the volume of issues that they're dealing with on this.
Representative Gordon. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the fact that justice really represents the state and our agencies, and separate councils represent the various counties, has any consideration been given to having a summit where the councils from the county and DAS and justice and all get together and work out between you all so you're on the same line when we end up? You're going to give us some recommendations. If they give us some recommendations, then we've still got a tension between the two.
Mr. Chair, if I, Representative Anderson, if I may answer, you heard on Monday from Dan Olson, County Council from Washington County. He represents the counties on this team that I've described before, state and local county, state and local government coordination. Also meeting with that team is Glenn Klein, attorney for the city of Eugene. So we have representatives of cities and counties meeting with me and the Department of Justice so that we're making sure what questions they're asking and or if you're wanting some sort of guidance on, we're letting them know what directions we're heading as we know. Having said that, again, you may have cities that belong to the league and you may have counties that belong to the association, but ultimately it will still be their own legal counsel that makes the final call. But in terms of coordinating at that organizational level, you bet, we're coordinating on a weekly basis.
Lane, a question, sort of follow-up to a question-and-answer dialogue we had a couple of weeks ago, and I think you informed us that the agency did not have the legal authority to require an appraisal as a part of the process. I seem to think that's bad policy. Do you expect to come before us and ask for authority to have appraisals as a part of the state claims processing of Measure 37 claims?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, as to the issue of appraisals in or out of the process, I think Mr. Cutler is probably best positioned to answer that. No, at this point, we've not got a legislative proposal to come in to request authority to require appraisals. That's just not on the list of our things for us to be coming in for.
So then that would reflect the state position that appraisals are not necessary in the Measure 37 process.
Mr. Keller, maybe best to answer that.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, we've never said that they're not required for the process. All we have said, and it's embodied in the rules, is that Department of Administrative Services and the state agencies don't have any authority to require that a claimant submit an appraisal along with the claim. That doesn't mean that the state cannot ask for an appraisal. It also doesn't mean that the state can't perform an appraisal on its own. Ultimately, on the procedural side of it, the state can determine what it needs in order to determine whether there's been a reduction in fair market value. And if the state needs an appraisal, there's nothing to prevent the state from going out and getting it. The only limitation is we don't believe the state can order a claimant to provide it along with the claim at this point.
Well, but do you think that's a good public policy or a bad public policy? And I don't want to hear that you don't want to make a policy answer. I just, just within the general framework with your background and training and instincts and whatever, is that good policy or bad policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, thank you for giving me the opportunity to state policy because pretty much the rest of the time I'm told not to do it. And if I were the czar of that issue, yes, I would require an appraisal from the claimant.
Then why don't you make that recommendation to the agency and to us and let us work on it?
I may do that.
Thank you.
That and several other issues. We'd love to hear from you. Any other questions from the committee? Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. These are difficult times. We appreciate you being candid and being here.
And we'll get that claims information to you as you requested.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, Chair.
We now move, Representative Smith has an agricultural committee meeting here today at 3 o'clock, 3:30. So we have somewhat of a time constraint, but I don't think it's going to be bothersome. But I'd like to have Tom Hughes, the mayor of Hillsborough, Hal Bronner, city councilor in Corvallis, and Steve Bryant, the manager, city manager in Albany. And we have two other gentlemen also part of this panel, but I'll bring them up together, and that's Glenn Klein and James Lewis. So, good afternoon, gentlemen. You can inquire whatever as to who wants to go first.
I guess I get senior by rank.
There you go.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hughes. I'm the mayor of the city of Hillsborough. I don't have very extensive prepared a message for you today. I think that one of the things that you'll hear from the three of us is the breadth, both in terms of the response of our individual response to Measure 37, and also a little bit about the kind of variety of claims that cities have begun to acquire. And I would like to raise a couple of cautionary notes on the application of the bill from representing a city that is virtually surrounded by farmland, and farmland that is still being farmed by families of homesteaders and folks who, for some reason or other, seem all to have the same characteristic in that they have now moved into their mid-60s and have begun to say, maybe this is a good opportunity to cash out at least part of my land and move into retirement. So that's a general concern that I have, and I'd like to address that towards the end. We, in response to Measure 37, we passed a resolution on in December 7th that simply determined how we would receive claims, identified the information that we wanted on a claim, and then left to the discretion of the city manager what recommendation to make back to the city council about individual claims that we might get. I suspect that we did not anticipate getting a claim very quickly. And what we are now doing is in the process of hammering out an ordinance that will look at how we evaluate the claims and what basis we use. That ordinance is not yet in place, but we have a claim. And it's an intriguing claim, and I think that it raises perhaps more ambiguities for you to contemplate, and is valuable in that regard. I think it is, without prejudicing the case, that as I describe it, I think you'll see some areas where it could likely be turned down as a claim. This is a parcel of land that prior to the passage of Measure 37, was in Washington County. It was zoned EFU at the time of purchase, I don't know the exact specific time of purchase, but it's just a few years ago. In 1998, it was brought into the urban growth boundary by a metro decision, which was then challenged in court, and through a lengthy, which is in lawyer language means expensive, process, we litigated that case and were able to get what in those days was called romantically enough Area 55 into the urban growth boundary just south of the city of Hillsborough. We then proceeded to do the master planning on the process. That included this particular parcel, by the way. We did the master planning on the process, and during the master planning part, designed a road to allow for the proper movement of the traffic that was going to be created by the subdivision out onto a major highway. The folks who owned this parcel testified during public hearing that they did not want the road located as it was located in their master plan, but the planning department and planning commission determined that was the best place for it, so they went ahead with that. Prior to the final adoption of the plan, and certainly prior to the adoption of Measure 37, but subsequent to the annexation into the urban growth boundary, the property owners were offered $552,000 for the property by a developer. Subsequent to the plan going into effect, the developer has now withdrawn the offer and said he'll only give them $500,000 because of the location of the road. They have then filed a claim against us for the $52,000 difference, arguing that our action devalued the value of their property. A couple of ambiguities it seems to me that raises. do we receive credit in all of that evaluation for our legal fees in terms of bringing the land into the urban growth boundary? Have we not, in fact, elevated the land beyond what it was worth as a UFU land by bringing it in? And does that offset the very specific nature of this particular claim? And I think one of the things that you may hear from cities is that we're not going to get the kinds of generic claims that the counties are getting, even though you've already heard about and you've heard the variety of claims the counties are getting. But ours are relatively specific. This one, you'll note, does not cite any state action or any regional action that devalued the value of land. It's strictly, the claim would be, if it were allowed, would be strictly against the city of Hillsborough. I think that raises some ambiguities that perhaps need to be clarified in the law. When does the clock start ticking in terms of evaluating? Does it go all the way back to when they first acquired the land? In this particular case, they could use it for farmland and nothing else. Or is there some subsequent time but prior to the passage of 37? We think that's a little bit unclear yet. And then the other question is, how do you compute this whole aggregate increase in value that applying better planning to a particular parcel brings to it? I think there was an article in the Oregonian that spoke to the increase in aggregate value, for example, in a subdivision of having CC&Rs. And even if that CC&R doesn't allow you to do what you want to do with your land, doesn't it protect all of us in general from bad things happening? Similar argument could be made, I think, for zoning ordinances in that they add aggregate value. The two concerns that I have really about this, the application of this measure, and I think we're well capable within our legal staff of dealing with this particular issue. But the concerns I have are and this goes back to the claims that you heard from Washington County. We have a lot of land north of the city outside of our urban growth boundary, and in an area that we have really not intended to develop for a number of reasons. We probably won't ask for inclusion in an urban growth boundary expansion for a number of reasons. One is it begins to push us close to the boundaries of North Plains, and so we sort of reduce that amount of barrier between the open space between us and our neighboring cities. It, while not exactly valuable farmland, it is still EFU land, and it's under the flight path of our airport. And as someone who has for the last 6 years gotten to get all the complaints from the people who complain south of the airport about the airport noise, the last thing we want is a bunch of people north of the airport. So I'm concerned about maybe working with you and with DLCD and a variety of other folks to try to develop tools that allow us to go into those areas and figure out, along with the property owners, how we can do some sort of long-range planning that gives them some assurance and some value, but doesn't promote really bad planning in terms of requiring single-acre lots with wells and septic tanks, which we think probably sets us up for a health hazard annexation later on. And then the other concern that I have that we kind of touched on a little bit today.
Can we go back to that story you told me? Because I want to make sure they understand it. It seems to me what happened is we had land. There was a land use action that increased the value. That's bringing it into the urban growth boundary. There was another land use action, citing the road and plotting the subdivision, that increased their value further. Their claim is, if however you had done a different land use rather than the one you had done, it might have increased it even more?
Well, they know it would have increased it more because they had an offer.
But that's not because they're not claiming you did a land use they're claiming you didn't do a land use that would have been better for them.
It is a little convoluted, yes, sir. Representative McGee,
I suppose you can claim anything.
I think there's a good chance that we will find that they don't have a claim. But
how does this relate to Measure 37?
And the Measure 37 claim?
It's a 37 claim.
It's for land use.
I'm happy to say it. I think it does raise those issues about the ambiguity in terms of the value and the ambiguity of the timing, whether we acknowledge it or not. But the third concern I have that I I would just touch on briefly, and that is that I'm concerned that a process be established whereby if we are presented with a claim that actually does relate to something we've adopted at the request of the state or under the direction of the state or at the direction of the regional government in our area, that either that claim escalates to the government that's made the requirement, or we be allowed to waive. What I would hate to see is us getting in the position where if we waive, we're not in compliance with state or regional regulations, so we would be required by one of those agencies to actually pay the claim rather than waive. And if that's going to be the case, it would be, I think, appropriate for the agency holding us accountable to actually have to assume responsibility for the claim. And then I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Does the city of Hillsborough have a compensation fund at this point?
We're in the process of creating one, and as I say, all we have right now is a plan for how to receive the claims. We don't have a compensation pot. We have no money designated to compensate. And in this particular case, again, if somewhere along the way somebody in a weird way were to require us to compensate, my guess is we would compensate out of the cost of the street, or I think we perhaps would even find a way in this particular. But again, the nature of our claims, I think, at the city level are going to be even more varied than those of the county, and they'll all be, I think, very strange.
Mayor Hughes, who, in your opinion, who do you believe should be making these land use decisions in the city of Hillsborough?
Of the type, Mr. Chairman, of the type that I just described?
In regard to claims.
I believe that the city of Hillsborough ought to be able to make a judgment about which claims to pay and which claims to waive if we're going to pay the claim. I mean, I think it basically is a part of the home rule authority that we be able to determine how we're going to spend our money, and this is a fundamental decision. So that, and I'm not as concerned about claims that we would have to pay on our own ordinances as much as I am on ordinances that we would choose to hold them accountable. But if, for example, we were required by Metro in this particular case to adopt a series of ordinances relative to, and the one we've had discussion with them on has been industrial land, and we subsequently get a claim because we've adopted that as city ordinance, that waiving city ordinance might put us out of compliance, and so we'd be forced to pay the claim. And I'm just saying, if we escalate, let's escalate that up to the people who actually passed the regulation in the first place.
That's a good question. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Cal, do you want to go next?
I'll go next. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Hal Bronner. I'm a council person from the city of Corvallis. I've been on the council now for starting my third term. Just as a little bit of history, I never thought I'd be sitting in this place at this stage. Back in my checkered past, I was McCall's assistant to the Senate that worked on Senate Bill 100, and I was the second director of LCDC department in the 70s when we first were setting up some of the regulations that have evolved since then. Now sitting on this side of the planet, it brings me into an interesting situation. City of Corvallis is very much in the same situation as the city of Hillsborough. I second some of the concerns that the good mayor has raised in terms of the clarifications this evening. I won't repeat those. I agree with him that the type of claims we get will be, in many cases, significantly different than what you'll see from county government. We're in the process of developing an ordinance. We had a first draft of it after giving some direction to legal counsel and staff and getting their advice. At our meeting last Monday, we'll be adopting our ordinance at our next meeting, hopefully. We thought we wouldn't be getting any claims, as the city of Hillsborough thought too, early on, but we do have one claim that's been filed, we think. the person who's filed has been a little nebulous as to whether it's really a 37 claim or not, but he's holding open the possibility that it is a 37 claim. And it relates to a piece of property in the commercial section that this owner has held for a while that has, it's a 7-acre parcel. He's putting in storage units on it, and it's in the edge of a floodplain, and he has a fill permit. And he had a fill permit that could have filled in a significant portion of the whole area. He's there's a time limitation on the fill permit, and he's done part of the project, and there's a part of it that has a couple of houses on it that he's rented out, and he didn't want to fill that part yet with the rent, and his fill permit has expired, and his claim is that we should not let that permit expire, and we should grant it. The new code updates that we've adopted to be in compliance with the SADC and floodplain requirements says this piece of property under our new codes would require raised slopes for floodway. And while that hasn't yet been approved for final appeal actions, he's also making a claim under that if that should prohibit him. So we're in the process of working with that one through, and we'll see whether there's really a valid claim or not. And that's the one we've received. So again, a wide variety of type of claims that can come in, whether valid or not, we'll see. To the ordinance that we've developed based on our policy and direction and our advice from council, we gave directions on Monday, and I might go through some of the perspectives that are behind that for your information. We want all the claims that come through us to be transparent in a public process. We think the community needs to know. Corrales is very much of a process, procedure, citizen involvement community, and we feel that if we're going to potentially waive, or compensate for actions that result from things that's going through a very significant public process, the public ought to be aware of what those claims are and see those. So all of our claims will be coming before the City Council, according to the direction we gave. We gave direction that the fee system needs to be set up that covers the cost of the claim processing. We don't have funds in our budget for this unfunded mandate. And as we do with other development fees, we directed that a fee be set up to cover full cost. The difference between this, obviously, and our ongoing development costs, we have a long history of processing costs and so forth on the other development costs, so we can set average costs and set the fees based on those averages. We obviously don't have that history on these type of claims. So the draft ordinance we have says that they will pay an initial filing fee of $500, and that the total fee will be whatever it costs us to process the claims. We're requiring in the application that the claimant needs to provide an appraisal and other documentation that will allow us to make an informed decision. We are putting in the ordinance the statement that, or the requirement that the waiver, if a waiver is granted through the process, that the waiver rides with the claimant and the family is defined in Measure 37 and not with the land. And we recognize that the claimants have the right to the public information, and we will probably provide that under the open meeting laws to any claimants to help them with the claim, but we're not going to go to extraordinary measures to undo things that our citizens have already voted on beyond helping that person with their information. And those are kind of the directions we gave within the ordinance we're about ready to adopt. We will see what happens on statewide determinations and final court cases, how many of those or all of whether all of them will stand up, that we feel strongly that this is the way it should be, and that's what we've put in our ordinances.
Any questions from the committee? How much influence will you put on the local decision making, and perhaps I should have asked Mayor Hughes the same question. How much emphasis will you put on whatever the state comes up with? In other words, will you use that as a base? Will you just kind of...
Depends on how the state comes up with it. Obviously, you pass a law, we'll follow the law. if it's guidance that the Attorney General gives to the state agencies, we will look at that. Our attorneys will look at that. We will give weight to that. But our final legal advice is from our assigned counsel.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. In fact, I think we are moving towards adopting ordinance. The philosophy in Hillsborough on issues like this has always been that the first bird gets the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese. And so we're waiting for some of the others to put their head in that trap before we jump in after them. And I think that based on some of the court decisions as well as what the Attorney General recommends, will probably be how we'll craft our ordinance too.
Well, you can always go the way Cook County is doing, and that's suing themselves over their application ordinance, which is Steve Bryant, City Manager, Albany. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I sympathize with your task, and I hesitate to complicate it further, but I think you have obviously demonstrated an appreciation for the difficult issues that we're faced with, and I would echo the prior two comments from the elected officials here about how the cases that are coming before cities are going to be very unique and very different than those that you're seeing come from counties. And I think the response is a bit delayed in the municipal setting, and that because they're so complex and there are so many overlapping issues in terms of interagency coordination, and I'm going to give you an example of one that may be coming to us that will illustrate this, that many of the applicants are, just the cities are taking a wait-and-see attitude, many of the applicants are taking a wait-and-see attitude to determine, you know, what kind of issues are going to get filed and might they have a claim or how are they going to need to assert their claim, because it's not entirely clear given the ambiguities in the measure. We adopted prior to the effective date an ordinance, and I've passed out for you two documents. One is our actual ordinance that we adopted on December 1st, which is sort of a minimalist ordinance to try to cover the basics because we anticipated that we might have some claims. And then the yellow page is just an information flyer for potential claimants to say, you know, kind of here's how we think Measure 37 works in the city of Albany. The first issue I'd like to cover with you is somewhat of an innovative approach that I'm not sure anyone else has adopted yet, but we thought you might be interested in it. I don't know if it has application for potential state claims, but we think it could work well for cities. And that is what we're calling an alternative claim resolution process. Essentially, what we're trying to do is set up some incentive for a claimant to come and negotiate with us, to say, before we actually file a formal claim, let's talk about whether we think we have a claim and whether, in fact, the city agrees that we have a legitimate claim. And we would enter into sort of an alternative dispute resolution process, where we would sit down and look at what are the minimal regulations that we might waive in a case where we agree there's a legitimate claim without going through the formal process. And that has a couple of advantages. Number one, it doesn't start the 180-day clock while we're negotiating. And so if we can come to some alternative dispute resolution process without starting that clock, it takes the pressure off of us to come to some premature resolution. So that's the first thing. And in order to do that, we've got to give the applicant some incentive to go through the process. So the incentive that we give is we agree to waive any application fees if they complete that process successfully. And secondly, we agree to a process where we would conduct a public hearing that could result in our finding that there is sufficient public interest in resolving this claim through the alternative process, that we would waive the private right of action clause you see many local ordinances adopting. And essentially what that is, I don't know to what degree that's been discussed at this committee, but there's a presumption based on most attorneys' analysis of this that if you grant a waiver to a property and that waiver has the effect of devaluing the neighbor's property, the neighbor could then sue the claimant for damages to their property. And what we're saying is, in our ordinance, we're going to have a private cause of action clause that essentially grants neighbors the authority to sue claimants for devaluing their property by virtue of their waiving a regulation, our waiving a regulation. But in the alternative claim resolution process, we will hold the ability to essentially take that ability away in order to incentivize the parties to come to some mutual agreement that is less damaging than would be granting the entire claim. So a little bit convoluted, but it's a process that we're experimenting with. We haven't had a chance yet to apply it. We'd certainly be happy to come back to you and describe our experiences with it if we're able to use it with any degree of success.
Question, Representative Smith.
I have a quick question. If you are going to allow the neighbor to sue because of their devaluation, are you going to require an appraisal or some claim that it actually devalued the property? How are you going to base that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, very likely I think that kind of process would result in appraisals in order to determine that. Although at that point there was a private right of action, the city kind of steps out of the process, and it is the property owners who fight that out with the courts, where the adjacent property owner is going to sue his or her neighbor for some loss of value, and presumably there will be the typical sort of civil process that goes on to determine at the judicial level what that loss is. So the city isn't involved in determining or making that determination. That becomes a civil matter between the two adjacent property owners.
Follow.
Then do they not have the right now or the authority to sue a neighbor?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, most of the attorneys and Glenn Klein will be here on the next panel and would be better at addressing that, but I believe most attorneys who have looked at this believe that is the case. It would be helpful if the Attorney General made that clear. It would be more helpful if that were stated clearly in statute, because it's not stated clearly in the measure. So one of the things that would be helpful to local governments is for the legislature to make that clear in statute. And one thing I'll say at this point that relates to your earlier discussion with the representative from the AG's office is that while the AG opinions are helpful to us, for us it's just another attorney's opinion. It has no particular weight unless it's embodied in statute. So inasmuch as we agree with those opinions and would like to follow them, it would be more helpful to us to have some of these issues resolved in statute. And I think you'll hear, as this process goes on, some specific kinds of things where that would be helpful to us.
Steve, part of your ordinance also indicates that a neighbor can file an injunction.
Correct.
Against a neighbor.
Correct.
That would appear to me to really discourage 37 claims. If
that's our hope, Mr. Chair, is that that, and again, we're not certain as to whether that will stand up, but if you can imagine a situation where we waive a zoning provision that allows a party to put in a fast food restaurant next to a single family resident when the property had previously been zoned residential, and the residential neighbor says, you know, that has significantly devalued my property, you'd want to give them the ability, I would think, to file an injunction while they proceed on their private cause of action to prevent the restaurant from getting built, while they find out what's the ramifications of their potential loss in value. So that's there as a deterrent, and you'll see in our application form there's other strong language to applicants that suggests that there are issues that could cause them difficulty if we waive regulations, and they ought to proceed cautiously. And we've put that in fairly blatant language. That's how we're approaching it. Let me give you an example of a claim that might, again, illustrate the complexities of Measure 37 claims as they affect cities. Really, property that lies just east of the freeway in Albany, if you pass I-5 and you recognize that most of Albany is toward Corvallis on the west, but we're growing very rapidly on the east side around our airport and our convention center and Highway 20 as it goes out toward Lebanon. We have a property that's been in a family since, it's probably a century farm, been in the same family ownership for decades, before county zoning. And it has Highway 20 frontage within close proximity to our I-5 interchange. They requested annexation. They're in our urban growth boundary. They had a very restrictive county zoning designation once county zoning was applied in that area, but again, they owned the property before application of county zoning. They requested annexation with the intent of, after it was annexed, applying for a comprehensive plan amendment and zone change to attract a big box retail development on a site that is, quite frankly, very conducive to that kind of development. In our charter, annexations require a vote of the people. And it's sort of a two-step process. Number one, you decide whether to annex, and then number two, you decide how to zone the property in accordance with your comprehensive plan. So it was submitted to the voters approved it, and they were annexed, and then we started on the comp plan amendment zone change process to get the zoning in place because they had a buyer or a developer who was willing to put in a large hardware store, big box type development. In the process of processing the comp plan amendment, the state transportation planning rule kicked in. And essentially what that says is that you have to make transportation facilities adequate such that if you've got any state highway facilities that would be reduced to a below adequate level of capacity, that concurrent with the development, you must make those transportation facilities adequate. But on the state highway, that can be enormously expensive. And in this case, what failed in the transportation study for this project was the interchange itself at I-5. This property is about a quarter mile away from the state interchange, and under a new proposed state transportation planning rule, it creates an even greater burden on this particular property owner to rezone because they would bear the burden of making that interchange adequate to serve their commercial development. So the question, obviously, is being asked. Number one, you know, who's our claim against? The property owner is asking this question. We've owned the property since it was in county jurisdiction. The county had restrictive zoning that didn't allow us to exercise full value of our property. Is our claim against the county. City annexed the property and is now imposing more restrictive zoning provisions, and the city so far has denied a zone change and comp plan amendment that would allow us to achieve the retail development, so perhaps our claim is against the city. But the city is denying the comp plan amendment zone change because of the state transportation planning rule. So is our claim against the state? Or is it against all three? And as you heard in the previous panel, the advice that most claimants are getting is make your claim at all levels. So, you know, here's an example where all three of us are in the soup together. So the difficulty for us might be that we have no pot of gold to pay claims. This would be an enormous claim, incidentally. And we would likely waive our zoning regulations and allow a big box development to be built on essentially residentially or EFU-zoned land. The question comes down to what about the transportation planning rule? The state has no ability of its own to, LCDC at least, to enforce the TPR. They ask local governments to enforce the transportation planning rule in their evaluation of these zone change comp plan amendments. We think that the rules need to be made clear that cities, while the enforcer of these state rules, need to be able to tender their claims to the state, which is imposing the rule on us. I hate to come here to suggest the state accept an additional burden. You have so many already, and yet it simply is not either fair or reasonable to expect that local governments can waive state rules and regulations. And we've asked the department, how are you going to deal with local governments if we waive state regulations? Are you then going to place enforcement orders on local governments for being not in compliance with the statewide planning rules?
What was the answer you got?
The answer was, we're going to try to work with local governments as best we can and figure this out.
We're from the government, we're here to help, right?
Well, yes, and I appreciate the position that Mr. Shetterly is in, and he's been very good, I believe, in doing what he needs to do given his mandate. But I think they're stuck in this ambiguity situation as much as we are, and that they've got rules that they're expected to enforce and no authority to either waive or compensate, and also you're looking for direction. So, again, this was merely presented to help illustrate the problem that we're all in, the fact that we need clarity because we presently do not have it, and I suspect every case that comes before you will demonstrate why we need legislative clarity in helping to interpret this.
But again, the three of you today have that much in common with the counties who spoke with us earlier this week, in that any kind of regulation involving the processing of 37 claims has to allow local governments the flexibility to be able to make that land use decision themselves, mm-hmm. and not have a circuit court or anybody else doing it. It needs to be made by you. Would you all agree to that?
Agree. Yes, we do agree with that.
Any questions for Mr. Barnett? Mr. Bruno, when you commented you were LCD's second director, I have to just ask one quick question. At the time Senate Bill 100 was introduced and made law, and everybody loved it when it was first passed, what went wrong in your opinion, to cause Measure 37?
That's a very difficult question. First of all, I'm not sure everybody loved it when the first was in.
It was supposed to be very popular, at least that's what.
Well, we survived two statewide votes during my tenure as director for repealing the whole. We survived both those by narrow margins, so it was controversial from the day one. But I think it gained in popularity. I think the results of the land use law has been positive for the state of Oregon. I think that there are some items that brought as the department and cities and counties have had to deal with the implementation over time. There are some areas that could have been, in retrospect, handled a little differently that might have forestalled the day that 37 came on. But I'm not sure. I think there's been movements ever since it was first put in to undo some of the restrictions to allow people to deal with their land whatever they wish, and that wasn't what Senate Bill 100 and the 90s laws did. And there's Measure 37 found a way that gets in to try to, I think my opinion is, and this is my opinion, is that Measure 37 was not a compensation measure, but was a measure to get out from under regulations that people disagree with. I don't think that it has gone wrong. I think it's a natural evolution, and we've got to sort through this one, just like we had to sort through things in 73, like we had to sort through things as some of the goals were developed later in 70, when we brought in the Coastal Center Management Program, the Greenway Program, that was both under my watch, and as we started developing the whole system of state-local partnership that evolved on through the 80s and into the 90s. And so my opinion is that this is a natural evolution clarification. It is a situation where those who don't like regulations and don't want the regulations have tried to undermine it, and they found a place that they could work to undermine part of it. And we will see whether in fact that happens or whether and or not as we work our way through this chapter in the development of the land use laws for Oregon.
Any questions for any of our three?
Yes.
Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. And James Lewis, Community Development Director in Bend, and Glenn Klein. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon. Glenn graciously offered for me to go first, and Mr. Chair and Representatives. I'm James Lewis. I'm Community Development Director for the City of Bend. And as all of you know, I think Bend has experienced rapid growth over the past decade, and it's unprecedented growth. I've been in Bend for approximately 13 years now, and the population has tripled in the time that I've been there. So we've seen a lot of development, a lot of controversy regarding land use regulations. But to get to the claims, right now Bend has only four claims. And we've only talked with two other persons, property owners, that wanted to discuss the claims process, how our laws work, are they eligible for a claim under Measure 37. The claims that we have, though, total $3.82 million. The smallest of those is $200,000, and the largest is $2.2 million. And to echo some of the points made earlier by the other gentlemen that were up here, is it's a variety of claims. Some of those have to do with recent ordinances and land use regulations that the city has adopted, one of those being a compatibility rule that when a new subdivision is developed adjoining an existing subdivision, that the larger the lots in the existing subdivision, the larger the lots have to be in the adjoining subdivision just to get some compatibility. So what that does is, for the property owner that's developing, it reduces the number of lots that they can build, which has an effect on their bottom line, what they make off the property in the end. One of those other areas that we expect some future claims would be some regulations that we adopted protecting the Deschutes River and what we call areas of special interest. Those are unique geologic or geographic features in the city of Bend that were deemed worthy of preservation for community benefit. They put restrictions, for example, on large rock outcroppings that are on people's property, that they can't develop those areas, but they've been given a density bonus to increase the density and develop elsewhere on the property as kind of a trade-off for what was perceived as taking the right away to develop certain pieces of their property. Right now, getting back to the growth issues, I think the number of claims that we've seen has been low and would probably stay low, and that's because our existing, other than recent amendments to our zoning provisions, is our zoning ordinance has been in place for 25 years. And the vast majority of the citizens of Bend have moved there in the last 25 years or have changed homes or locations or sold property within the last 25 years. So it's not really known now the regulations that are on it or the regulations that were on there when they bought it. But the irony to that is we're in the final stages of periodic review, and the last thing we have to do is adopt a new development code. There would be new zoning regulations, new land division requirements, and new land use procedures ordinance. All of a sudden, when we adopt that, we potentially have 50,000 plus or minus properties in the city of Bend that could be eligible for a claim. Many people argue that the provisions that would be included in our new code would add value to a lot of properties, depending on how you define value. And I believe that to be true. But there are some provisions where we've seen a development pattern of a certain zoning designation, say high-density residential. That's been the intent for an area or piece of property. Go the way of some conditional uses that are allowed in the zone for some offices. So what we've seen is 75% of our high-density residential lands have been developed with offices. So new zoning provisions state that, or essentially take out that ability to do commercial development in the high-density residential zones. So we can get that that density that is embodied in a lot of our state land use laws. So we don't have to expand urban growth boundary and keep the rural lands rural. But upon adopting that, we open ourselves up to Measure 37 claims. So even though the number of claims that we have today is low, we would expect that we could get a number of claims in the future. Part of the issue there is that some of those claims may not be valid. We could receive a number of claims that we procedurally or administratively have to process and take staff time and resources that may not be valid. So I think, you know, from the City of Bend's perspective, that's a real issue. In times where we're trying to process a lot of legitimate land use applications and building permits and keep up with staffing and costs to do that work, we could be faced with a lot of work, a lot of claims that might not be legitimate when we adopt a new code. So, you know, aside from the claims process, which I'm going to talk to you about in the City of Denver real quick, a lot has been discussed about Measure 37 as the downfall of state land use planning. I don't see it being the downfall in terms of the type of development, the claims that we have right now. I'll just be very frank and very blunt that if we waived the requirements to allow what those folks wanted, it would not be the worst things that happened in Bend, Oregon. But the failure to move forward with new land use regulations and to set the stage and the direction for our community, which is growing is faster than any community in Oregon, would be a travesty. And again, I have to point out we've had 3 years of work on our zoning code with a lot of community input, and the vast majority of our people, residents, support it as being positive for the City of Bend. But getting into our process real quick is that our process, we've adopted an ordinance like many other jurisdictions. We have a claims form application that's modeled on the state form. Our ordinance, and something that's come up in discussion among staff and City Council, is that our ordinance initially is very restrictive about what needs to be submitted for a formal application. We require an appraisal and a lot of other information. The claims that we have now, we've met with them all, and they refuse to submit the appraisals and all of the information our ordinance requires. So one thing that's facing the City of Bend is a prospect of litigation for many avenues. One of those would be not complying with our own ordinance. We're faced with the fact, do we process these claims without the information that our own ordinance requires, and face possible litigation from various groups around the state for not complying with our own ordinance but trying to process these claims? Or do we go back and do we modify our ordinance, which is what I heard some folks earlier speaking to Mr. Shetterly on behalf of the state, essentially loosening or making less restrictive the requirements for a claim? Those are some of the things that we are facing right now. I think it was Mr. Bryant brought up, and something we discussed with our council, is this pre-claim determination negotiation that we could do with the claimants, which would mean rather than deny the claim or go to court over the claim or waive the requirements or pay the settlement, could we, and this is something that's brought up by our planning staff, could we work with the claimants to actually determine what it is they want to develop on their property? Because I, too, believe that it's not seeking monetary damages. It's to allow people to develop their property without as much restriction that's been placed on it. So essentially, it's like when you look at any lawsuit, often what's discussed is, can we settle? And so what we would be looking at is possibly sitting down with the claimants and saying, what is it that you want to develop? So rather than a wholesale waiver, we could come to some agreement with them, similar to a form of a development agreement, but not in the public hearing land use appealable process, where we determine what the city is assured of, what the residents are assured of, what's going to happen on that property, and then the claimant gets some surety as far as what they can develop on that property. I guess the last thing I'd like to point out is in terms of the ambiguities, there are a lot of ambiguities, and those ambiguities we see leading us into some type of litigation, some type of court action. The City of Bend, no different than anybody else, does not want to be the first to test those waters. But the big issues are, again, definition of the ownership, transfer of the development right to a new owner, the maybe better defining what the application requirements would be. I know there was talk about an appraisal. We believe we've requested appraisals. It's easy to determine the property value has gone up or down, but the amount is if Measure 37 is based upon a demand for compensation related to a dollar amount, we believe that an appraisal should be submitted. And I guess the last thing is a determination of value. This was discussed a little bit ago. I think it was Representative Greenlick that brought up if we have a rural residential subdivision, do those small lots potentially not be as much or worth as much as the large piece? So I think a lot of it comes down to the highest, determining the highest and best value for a piece of property. You consider the increased value from governmental regulation and investment. Bringing property, one of our claims is that when the people bought it, it was in rural Deschutes County outside of an urban growth boundary. There was no regulation. We believe, you know, that was a true statement, but by bringing it into the UGB, water and sewer are now available to it, protection from other land uses that would not be compatible have been provided, but that adds value to the property. Those things need to be taken into consideration for definition of value. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Any questions? Mr. Klein? We have about 10 minutes. I hope I'm not pushing you.
Not at all. That's fine.
Okay.
What I wanted to, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Glenn Klein, I'm an attorney with Harang Wong, Gary Rudnick. We serve as city attorney to a number of cities, including Eugene, Roseburg, Florence, Brownsville, so a range of cities. What I wanted to do, and I'll do it briefly so that you do have time for some questions if you want, is to pick up on a couple of themes that I've heard today, as well as some things that I've heard from Linda Ludwig at the League about other things that people have been talking to you about. The first is just to reinforce for you, if you need it, that the issues related to Measure 37 and cities are going to be different in some very significant ways from those for the counties as well as those for the state. The counties, I assume that what you heard a bunch of is that there's a lot of overlap between a county claim and a state claim. When a county waives one of its ordinances, there's still a significant possibility that there's a state statute or a state administrative rule that's going to apply to the same use. That's a lot less true inside city limits. There are very few state statutes that directly apply inside city limits. Most of the state statutes, as well as the statewide planning goals, are incorporated into the city codes, and then the state statutes and the state administrative rules fall out. However, there are still some, and to emphasize a point that other speakers had made, the principle that I would like to suggest to you is that the government that has the authority to waive ought to have the responsibility to pay. If a city doesn't have the authority to waive a state requirement, then the city shouldn't have the requirement to pay for that. Either the state ought to delegate to the city the authority to waive, or the state ought to assume the liability for that. And that would be true whether it's a city or county, but whoever has the responsibility to pay should have the authority to waive, and vice versa. The second thing, I'm going to jump around a little bit here. The second thing I'd like to mention, in terms of sharing of information, Mr. Chair, you had asked questions from the Department of Justice about putting out information. We have been trying, we, a number of local government's attorneys, have been trying to coordinate sort of our work among ourselves as well as with the Department of Justice in terms of trying to figure out what this measure means and how to implement it so that we could advise our clients. It seemed to us that we ought not to all be looking at exactly the same issue, but to the extent that we can share research, that will save all of our clients money. It also brings more interests, more experiences to that same problem. The difficulty has been, in fairness to the Department of Justice, the difficulty in them sharing some of their information with the rest of us, or for us to share information among ourselves, is that once we share attorney work product or attorney client privilege documents with others, we have lost the privilege. And what that now means is that developers, property owners, Oregonians in Action, the newspaper can now say, hey, I would like a copy of that three-page memo that you produced researching this particular question. Well, I'm unwilling to give my work product to anybody if it's going to result in the newspaper or a potential opponent in getting it. What we have been trying to work out among local government attorneys as well as with the Department of Justice is some kind of an agreement a confidentiality agreement that would actually allow us to share information back and forth without waiving those privileges. It's taking a lot longer than I had hoped, but it's still something that we're working toward, and I expect eventually we will achieve. In terms of the usefulness that the Department of Justice opinion would have in terms of at least my clients, I am very interested in seeing as much from the Department of Justice as I can get, not because I'm going to advise my clients to necessarily follow the advice of the Attorney General's office, but because there are a lot of very smart people at the Department of Justice, and I'd like to gain the benefit of their wisdom. The analysis that they go through in putting together their opinion is something that I can look at and say, hadn't thought of it that way, I agree with that opinion, and in 30 minutes I could provide some very good advice to my clients that if I had to research it on my own might have taken me 5, 10, or 100 hours. So having that information would be very useful, trying to get it in a way that also protects the state, because the Attorney General is going to have the same issue with its advice that I have with mine. They don't want their potential opponents to have access to that information, especially in an area like here where there are an awful lot of ambiguities and you don't want to share those theories because your opponents can then use them against you. A couple other quick things just to highlight for the committee. There are a number of jurisdictions which are going through what's called periodic review. And has the committee dealt with that concept before?
Yes.
Okay. One of the issues for cities and counties is having the state tell us, as they have over the last number of years, you need to do X, Y, and Z. You need to create new local regulations or changes to your comprehensive plan, and you need to adopt those as part of, in this case, periodic review. What's going to happen, and what is happening, and I'll give you a specific example with the city of Eugene, is we're going to finish that periodic review process. And for the city of Eugene, it's completing our Goal 5 inventory work, natural resource protection. And when we do that, and when we adopt natural resource protection measures for those sites that are on our inventory, we will be creating a bunch of new Measure 37 claims. One of the things that would be really useful is to, in essence, have some kind of moratorium on state mandates for local governments to create new regulations that are simply going to result in new Measure 37 claims. There are a number of jurisdictions, and Ben's not the only one, that wants to continue to move forward with land use planning. And how we do that without creating new Measure 37 claims is something that most of us haven't quite figured out yet, but it's the sort of thing that we would like to have the option to do should our jurisdictions decide they want to do it, but we would prefer not to have the state mandate that we go through a process that results in new Measure 37 claims. It's just a waste of money. And I think, Mr. Chair, that I hit the highlights that I wanted to address, and I'd be happy to answer questions. I
apologize to both of you if we've caused you to abbreviate the conversation. Both of you your testimony has been very, very informative, and we appreciate you being here. Any member of the committee have a question for Mr. Kleiner? What period of time, Mr. Kleiner, were you talking about that you'd want a moratorium on? Is there a specific time period in your mind?
Until Measure 37 goes away. I mean, the moratorium that I would like is, it's not really a moratorium, it's the state should not be requiring local governments to adopt new restrictions that are simply going to result in new Measure 37 claims. So to the extent that the state imposes any mandates on us to adopt new land use regulations, we should have the flexibility to be able to adopt them in a way that would not result in new Measure 37 claims. And right now, we don't have that flexibility, and in fact, LCDC doesn't have that flexibility in terms of periodic review. But to the extent that, and whether it's LCDC or ODOT or any other state agency, to the extent, or the legislature for that matter, to the extent that you're saying you need to do X, Y, and Z, don't impose a mandate on us that is simply going to result in Measure 37 claims that then results in a waiver and doesn't accomplish what you were hoping to begin with.
Well, the one thing that's becoming apparent, Measure 37 is going to keep a lot of attorneys employed around the state of Oregon.
I can certainly do that.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
I have a question. Are you saying on the moratorium then that you want a repeal of Measure 37?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, no, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that to the extent that I would like a moratorium on new state mandates for local governments to adopt new local regulations, I would like that moratorium on the mandate to last as long as Measure 37's waiver and claims process lasts. All I'm trying to do is say, don't require us to adopt new regulations that will result in new Measure 37 claims. If they don't result in Measure 37 claims, then there are other issues, but it's not a Measure 37 mandate issue.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Lewis, Mr. Klein, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. And, committee, we will not have a meeting on Friday. Monday, you might be prepared, we will have a work session amongst ourselves to discuss Measure 37. And the House Committee on Land Use is adjourned.